Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nobody gets to threaten the full faith and credit of the United States just to extract political concessions.
Wait, they don't? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by eCornell.com. Join an elite group of professionals and begin targeted online training in marketing that drives results and revenue. Visit eCornell.com/marketplace for 20% off your online marketing strategy certificate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 27th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us. We are just going to dig right in to get going, to bring a little analysis to the economic insanity this week. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal is down in Washington. Heidi Moore from The Guardian is at Marketplace East, our bureaus in New York. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Sudeep, I'm going to ask you, since you are there, where do you come down on this question? A government shutdown now would be better than a debt limit breach later.
Absolutely true. Okay. There is no question about that. It would be a shutdown in the coming days would be a good way to purge the politics, the really nasty politics out of the system now. And the cost of this, while there will be some concern, it won't be huge. And the bigger issue to watch is how do the shutdown fight dynamics play into the debt ceiling debate down the road. That is really what matters here, whether things get so crazy in the shutdown that it dooms any other negotiation for the debt ceiling.
Heidi, what do you think?
Yeah, I would have to agree. I mean, the debt ceiling, breaching the debt ceiling would be catastrophic for the economy, for the faith and credit of the U.S. government, as the president said, and also for our faith in America as a functioning country and not a banana republic. So if
as the president also said, by the way. Right. I mean, you basically did.
Yeah, exactly. We can't toy with these things. The dollar, as the president said, the dollar is the reserve currency for the world. The whole world economy does hinge on us to some extent. So we can't play with these things. If it's a matter of shutting down the government, I mean, that's about as rare as air molecules. We do that all the time and it's not a problem. But the whole debt ceiling thing is ridiculous. And what makes it more ridiculous is that there are even fewer Republicans supporting it now than there were in 2011 and 2012 when they threatened it before.
Okay. So here's what I don't understand, though. If everybody agrees that the debt limit, breaching it is bananas, Sudeep, and it would be apocalyptic, and that the stakes are higher this time than they were last time we were here, why isn't Wall Street losing its beans?
Well, Wall Street has seen what happened the last few times. You get to the point, the 11th hour, and then a deal is done. And I think Wall Street has started to understand that there are a lot of kids on the playground here. There are a lot of people making noise, throwing fits, doing things that look pretty ridiculous. But there are adults on the sidelines. The congressional leadership is very concerned about being the people in charge if you were to have a default on the debt. That's why I really don't think ultimately a debt default would happen. But I have absolutely no confidence we can avoid getting to the point where there's some damage to the economy and to markets before you have a deal. That's the problem with our politics today.
Heidi, do you think that potential damage from a default, I'm going to blow right by the shutdown thing because, as you said, we've done it a bunch of times in the past. Do you think the damage from a potential default has already started to be felt? I mean, that's what the president said today. You buy that?
Well, not on Wall Street, but, I would say that the damage of congressional inaction has been felt all throughout the economy for well on 4 years now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the issue with the default is, will the economy suffer even more? And the answer is it's certainly not helping. The economy is already in pretty bad shape. So why push it over the edge if we don't have to? You have, you know, incredibly high, historically high poverty. You have high unemployment. You have, you know, food stamps are going to be cut. The country's a disaster, and Congress is just, you know, playing with jacks with this thing. It's ridiculous.
All right. Disaster is a little strong, right? But I get your point. I get your point. Sudeep, how does this then end? Does it end at, you know, 12:01 a.m. on the 17th of October when Jack Lew said we're going to run out of money? Does it end with a deal or do we, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm going to say this, kick the can down the road?
It almost certainly ends with some kind of a can kick.
Yeah.
At least for the shutdown, we already know that's going to happen. Yeah. We're going to be fighting this again in the best case scenario in the next 2 or 3 months. But even for the debt ceiling, it doesn't get resolved until the last possible minute when everyone stops playing their political game and realizes that they actually have to legislate for a moment.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He's in Washington. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. She is in our bureaus in New York City. All right, you guys. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, traders, yeah, they pretty much had no mojo, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the marketplace desk of Capitalism Makes Strange Bedfellows today, this news. The Carlyle Group, which is a ginormous big-name private equity outfit, is going to take a stake in Beats by Dr. Dre, which is a big-name brand of headphones. The names being the rapper Andre Young, a.k.a. Dr. Dre, and music mogul Jimmy Iovine. Carlyle's investment is said to be $500 million, though neither side is confirming that. The investment that consumers make in these high-end headphones is $200 to $400 a pop. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to check out the pricey high end of the personal audio market.
There's a good chance you're listening to that song, Dr. Dre's Been There, Done That, on some mediocre car speakers or earbuds. Frank Wells, president of the Audio Engineering Society, says that's probably not what music fans want for listening to the latest club sound, hip-hop or electronic dance music.
The Beats headphones are designed to give that visceral bass thump experience that actually moves your body, the physical feel of it really kind of rattling your head.
Beats already controls more than half the premium headphone market. They can cost up to $400. Ben Arnold at the NPD Group says the big growth potential here isn't head-rattling clubgoers.
Now consumers are watching movies on HBO Go and Netflix, games. People are playing so many more games on their mobile devices.
Arnold says people spend so much time consuming media this way, they want to listen in quality. There are skeptics. They lit up my email and Twitter accounts today, like smartphone developer Jesse Ridgway, who tried his roommate's Beats back in college. He could afford them.
But I don't think it's the best use of money because the sound quality of most audio is not good enough to the point where you're going to notice a difference.
To counteract that frugalista attitude, Beats is betting on the cachet of Dr. Dre and the fashion statement that his audio gear makes. I kind of like the purple ones. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The biggest battle in college sports lately hasn't been happening anywhere near a field or a gym, more like in a courthouse. College athletes want a share of the royalties from video games that use their images, and victory may be in sight. Electronic Arts, the video game company, said yesterday it's going to stop making its popular college football video game, at least for now. And that was followed by news of a proposed $40 million settlement between former football players, Electronic Arts, and the collegiate licensing company. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR the NCAA is having none of it.
From the looks of this ad, NCAA football, the video game, is all about realism. From the grunts and body blows,
down to what shoes he wore, what color his hair was, etc., so that people playing the game could see it was Sam Keller.
That's Steve Berman, a lawyer for Sam Keller. The former University of Nebraska quarterback and other players sued Electronic Arts, along with the collegiate licensing company and the NCAA, for profiting from their likenesses. The terms of the settlement are still confidential, and they have to be approved by a federal judge.
But the net effect is that college athletes will get compensated for their image and likeness, and that itself is a landmark event.
Michael McCann directs the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire. There is an important wrinkle. The NCAA is still fighting the case. Its rules say college athletes can't be paid for playing sports. So McCann says current players may have to wait to cash in. As for Electronic Arts, dumping its college football game won't be a huge loss. Ben Schachter is an analyst with Macquarie Group.
What you're seeing in the entire video game industry is this shift towards fewer, bigger, better.
Like EA's blockbuster Madden NFL franchise, it outsells the college football game 3-1, and there are no pesky amateur rules to deal with. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was a big report today from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It says, yes, indeed, we humans are responsible for global warming. To be precise, it says it's, quote, extremely likely that we're the cause, which is up from very likely in 2007. And if you take the time to read the whole 30 pages of that report, you'll come across a whole lot of italicized likelies and very likelies, all very precisely thought out. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is virtually certain to explain.
What's the difference between saying something is extremely likely and very likely? For most of us, probably not a lot. But for the IPCC scientists, the difference is 5 percentage points. Extremely likely means that scientists now think there's a 95% chance global warming is caused by us people. That's up from the very likely, indicating a 90% chance. Turns out the IPCC has an entire likelihood scale associating probabilities with words. Michael Mastrandrea is a professor at Stanford. He helped develop the scale.
If you ask people what you think a term like likely or very likely or extremely likely means without any kind of a definition, you get very different answers for what they think those mean in terms of probabilities.
The scale gives everyone a consistent language. They also have set tiers of confidence from very low to very high.
Do you guys just at some point start making jokes about it's extremely likely I'm going to order steak for dinner?
I think we do that all too often, unfortunately, but I have pretty high confidence. I should say I have high confidence that they are not very good jokes.
I love scientists so much. Alex Hall is a professor at UCLA. He worked on the IPCC report and with this language.
In climate science, we do have to be very, very honest about what we do and what we know and what we don't know. And this uncertainty language is a way for us to talk about that.
All science has uncertainty. And while human responsibility for global warming is now called extremely likely, there's less certainty about the speed and effects of climate change.
The true state of knowledge about climate is shades of gray, not black and white.
And this likelihood language helps scientists communicate those shades to the public while making clear that now's the time to do something about it. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Yes, the debt limit and budget messes are soaking up a lot of the media oxygen out there, but there is substantive work being done elsewhere. At the United Nations, for one, the Security Council is said to be near an agreement on next steps for Syria's chemical weapons. Syrian expatriates in the United States are, of course, paying close attention, as they have been for years, but in a very personal way. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick spent some time with one of this country's biggest Syrian American communities.
Syrians started migrating to Detroit more than 100 years ago. Today, many are newer immigrants who still have close ties to Syria. In a suburban park, about 100 Syrian Americans gather to demonstrate against President Bashar al-Assad. Ibrahim al-Kalani stands on the fringes of the protest. He says it's hard to get a hold of relatives in Syria. And even when you do, conversations take place in a kind of code.
I call it secret Syrian ways of communication. We use funny words and different expressions, basically to evade Syrian monitoring of the telephone lines.
Wael Hakmeh says it's not easy to send money to relatives there. At this point, you pretty much have to find someone to smuggle money directly into the country. Even then, there are dangers to spending U.S. dollars.
And the Assad regime now is jailing people who use currency other than the Syrian pound because they don't want the continued devaluation of the pound.
Hakmeh is an emergency room physician. There are lots of doctors in Michigan's Syrian community. Some now go back to provide medical aid. Other Syrian Americans help out from afar, like holding frequent fundraisers for humanitarian aid.
Consistently, these fundraisers have all raised over $1 million.
That's Lena Masri, an attorney originally from Damascus. One thing Southeast Michigan's Syrian community doesn't lack is money. Masri herself has taken on dozens of refugee cases. Their applications show that a lot of refugees in the U.S. get money and other support from Syrian Americans.
From shelter to utilities to, you know, everyday expenses.
That kind of generosity, even from strangers, is something Dr. Adnan Hamad has seen again and again. He works for an Arab American social services agency.
This community is about a generation of immigrants receiving a second generation of immigrants.
It's not all rosy, though. There are those rebel supporters back at the park. But there's also a pro-Assad faction in the Detroit Syrian community. The conflict has ended friendships and split families. But Hamad is confident the larger Arab American community will pull together to support displaced Syrians. He's seen waves of traumatized refugees come to Michigan over the years and have to start all over again.
They don't have a home, they don't have health, they don't have a job.
But Hamad says that within a few years, many have completely rebuilt their lives, and they end up contributing the most to the next wave of refugees. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Swick for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'll have a cheeseburger. Hold the cheese. Hold it in your hand until it melts.
Comedy in the age of social media. But first, let's do the numbers. Two words, my people, government and shutdown. The Dow Industrials lost 70 points, about a half percent, 15,258 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ shaved off 5 points, a 10%, settled at 3781. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 0.4%, 1691. There for the week, the Dow off 1.3%. The S&P 500 gave back 1.1%, but the NASDAQ added 0.2%. Nike kicked up 4.5% today on yesterday's strong earnings report. JCPenney fell 13% after announcing a big stock offering. The retailer wants to raise money for its turnaround plans. Can I say much-needed turnaround plans? Yeah, I think I can. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 2.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by eCornell.com. Join an elite group of professionals who have empowered themselves and their organizations with targeted online training and marketing that drives results and revenue. Earn an online Ivy League marketing certificate in as little as 3 months. Move ahead today. Visit eCornell.com/marketplace for 20% off your online marketing strategy certificate. Now is the perfect time. That's eCornell.com/marketplace. Ivy League for the real world.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up September 30th. In case you missed it, September is National Mushroom Month. Plan over the weekend and cook up on Monday, the final official day, to celebrate the fungi. Oscar winner Marion Cotillard turns 38. And hang out at the water cooler. Discuss the series finale of Breaking Bad. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Seriously? Hello, Kitty?
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know that saying about money not buying you love? How about love getting you some money? Online dating last year was $1.5 billion industry, and growing, I should say. You throw mobile in there, romance via smartphone, if you will, and the possibilities are endless. Audrey Quinn has a look at the first mobile app to really gain a following with women.
It's 9:30 on a Tuesday night, and 30-year-old Emily Johnson pulls up the Tinder app on her iPhone. Pictures of men pop up one at a time.
I tend to go through these pretty fast.
She set a filter. Men, 28 to 45, within 2 miles of her Brooklyn apartment. She swipes her finger to the right if she likes a guy, left if she's not so into him.
No, weird yellow spiky hair. No, don't like sporty pics. Pink shorts, that's a no. This one looks promising. We can give him a chance. He has a nice beard, nice bicycle.
If Johnson likes a guy's profile, and he likes hers too, Tinder puts them in touch.
Okay, exciting. So I actually just got a match. Did you see that?
She and the guy can message back and forth. And if that conversation goes well, they'll meet up.
It's like an easier, more convenient way to meet people than just, say, going to a bar. And it's essentially the same thing as going to a bar, right? Like, you look at a person across the room and you're like, that person is attractive enough for me to talk to.
Johnson says Tinder's a lot easier than regular online dating. All she had to do was sign up using her Facebook profile. That Facebook connection, it's made Tinder more palatable for a lot of women. Past phone-based dating apps have emphasized anonymity. Take Grindr, for example, the meetup site for gay men.
With the success of Grindr, one of the questions that the company was often asked is there a way for men and women who want to meet each other to have something similar?
That's Jamie Wu. He's author of the book Meet Grindr. He says Grindr introduced its offshoot for straight people in 2010. It was called Blender.
I think it became very obvious that women were not interested in using Blender.
He says Blender had too much of Grindr's meat market aesthetic, and the few women who did use it got overwhelmed by unsolicited messages from men. Tinder's different.
In Tinder, you can't really contact someone until they've agreed that you're a match. So there's kind of this almost lottery feeling to it, because you don't know whether or not someone's going to respond to you, and that kind of stuff is really engaging to app users.
Tinder now makes about 2 million matches a day. Normally, when something like Tinder suddenly strikes it big, you hear a lot of IPO buzz. But Tinder's already owned by IAC. That's the big media company that also has Match.com and OkCupid. Susan Ettlinger is a tech industry analyst at Altimeter Group. She says Tinder's big payoff could come from its data. It knows a lot about its users.
If you think about Tinder being for people who are young, who are single, knowing where they go, what they do, who they like is really helpful in terms of understanding how to sell to them.
With that kind of data, Tinder could get super personal.
One thing that could happen over time is, what if they see that you are getting serious with somebody? They could offer a ring. They could offer a wedding dress ad.
That aside, Tinder users say the app's addictive. And IAC may be able to use that hype to drive people to OkCupid and Match.com. I asked Emily Johnson whether Tinder might lead her to try those other dating sites.
I think it's increased my comfort level with the idea of meeting a person from the internet.
Tinder just might be your gateway drug.
Yeah, Tinder might be my gateway drug.
In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Comedy is a notoriously tough way to make a living. It can take years for a comedian to get that big break. Unless, it turns out, you get lucky on YouTube. Bo Burnham was 17 when he hit it big on YouTube. 6 years later, he's expanded onto Twitter and Vine. He is, you might say, a new media comedian who's now out with an old media book of poetry, as it happens. It's called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. Hey, Bo, how are you?
Good. How are you, Kai? Thank you for having me.
I'm good. I have to tell you, though, this is a weird book, man.
Thanks.
And I believe you mean that, because clearly you meant this to be a weird book.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a silly little sort of thing. I think it was sort of a year of letting my mind wander.
I'll sound like a radio professional. Is it, were you trying to be funny? Are you just trying to get yourself out there? Why do this book?
I did a lot of poetry in my stand-up and in my comedy. And I don't know, I've been writing songs that were sort of comic songs, and then stand-up jokes are a little bit lyrical. And I just thought that there's a certain line between jokes and music and poetry that is a bit blurred in my mind. So I thought I'd write this little silly thing.
It is. There are parts of it that are charming. And then there are parts of it that just kind of make you go, wait, what? And I want you to read two of these little thoughts, I guess. The first one is called Hold the Cheese, and I just want you to read that for me.
Oh, great, yeah. I love a cheeseburger. Hold the cheese. Hold it in your hand until it melts, until it bears that shape of that voluptuous palm of yours. Then put it on my burger. That's poetry. That's Keats.
I love that. Right?
That's Keats.
Hold the cheese. I actually chuckled out loud. All right. Now let's go to this one's near the end. And this one actually is, I thought this was lovely.
This is called Forever in an Instant. Forever in an instant met up one day, had a short but lovely talk, then each went on its way.
That just kind of makes you go, whoa, really? That's cool.
That's a nice little thing. See, they're just little nice little nuggets. That's the thing. It's sort of a poetry in the little Twitter world that we have.
I would say it's 99.5% certain that most of the people who are listening to this radio show have never, ever heard of you.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So introduce yourself. What are you? What do you do?
My name is Bo Burnham. I'm a comedian. I started online, sort of posting videos on YouTube when I was 16, sort of little silly songs.
Like stuck in your bedroom and you just threw it up there?
Basically, yeah. I was doing sort of theater in my high school, and I started writing sort of silly songs on the piano backstage in summer theater, and then I eventually put them online and sort of got this sort of little following, I guess.
Like in the hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah. Well, not hundreds of millions of people. I think there's like 100 million views, but
not the same thing. That's true.
Those are all, you know, and who knows? I think I'm convinced like half of them are bots and another half are repeats, so who knows?
But it goes from there to Comedy Central, a stand-up show. You were what, 18?
Yeah.
Plus or minus? Book, you had a thing on MTV, short-lived, but a thing on MTV.
Yeah.
I mean, you are a little bit of a conglomerate here at the age of 23.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's just I think they're all sort of similar little things. I just like to write and then perform. I think those are the sort of two sides of the coin. I think sort of in this business or whatever, you're able to, if you play it right, you can kind of spread it out into a lot of mediums.
I was watching an interview with you, and it might have been actually when you were on Conan. And you guys were talking about something, and you said, you know, why did that person just laugh at this joke? Why did the audience just laugh at what we were talking about? And I got to wondering whether it matters to you why people laugh at your stuff.
It definitely matters to me. I don't know exactly what comedy is accomplishing or why people laugh exactly, but I am very concerned with where my laughs are coming from. There's certainly earlier jokes that I have, things I wrote when I was 16 that I've since said I do not like and I won't ever say again because I think it's getting laughs for the wrong reason or when being slightly bullying. Or
when you go back and listen to yourself at...
I don't. Yeah, I can't. I don't even
really?
Listen to
myself. Yeah, me neither. So there we go. Bo Burnham. His book is called Egghead, or You Can't Survive on Ideas Alone. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a couple of quick ones, actually. Number one, as you settle in for whatever football games you choose to watch this weekend, pause for a moment for that yellow first down line on your screen. It debuted 15 years ago today on ESPN. Google also turns 15 today, which gets us to this from a Pew Research Center report. 56% of internet users say they have Googled themselves, which means 44% of y'all are just lying. All right, we're done. We got to go. That is Marketplace from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. It's produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday. And this is APM.